Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. COVID at a crossroads as states look to reopen. One new government model forecasts a dramatic increase in U.S. deaths by June 1st. Then how contact tracing can mitigate the spread of the coronavirus and limit the pandemic. Plus, the Supreme Court goes live for the first time, streaming oral arguments in real time as the court meets via telephone to comply with social distancing rules. And the U.S. Senate returns to Washington. The House stays home as protests around the country challenge governors on opening up. Our Politics Monday team previews the week. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The world begins a new week in the COVID-19 era, and the global death count has reached 250,000. That includes 68,000 in the United States. Meanwhile, state by state, the country is taking more steps toward reopening. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
Barbers in Omaha, Nebraska were back at work today.
Financially, it's been real bad, but I think I pretty much missed the atmosphere of being able to cut hair and being around people.
The state is further easing restrictions on some of the businesses shuttered by the pandemic. Owners say it's a positive step toward a new normal.
We'll be doing appointments only, because we can only have 10 people in the shop at once.
The new wave of reopenings has come amid a push and pull across the country on when and how to resume public life. California Governor Gavin Newsom said some retailers in his state could resume doing business this week. In South Dakota, a Smithfield pork processing plant, formerly closed due to hundreds of COVID-19 infections, began partially reopening today. And Boston was the scene of the latest protest demanding that officials drop restrictions as hundreds gathered outside the state Capitol building. In the nation's capital, the Senate gaveled in for the first time in more than 5 weeks. That wasn't the case across the Capitol, where the House of Representatives opted to stay away, while Washington, D.C. remains a virus hotspot. Over the weekend, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi declined the Trump administration's offer to provide the rapid testing being used to screen visitors at the White House. In a rare joint statement, they said those resources should go to frontline workers, where they can do the most good the most quickly. Meanwhile, on Sunday, in a Fox News town hall, President Trump urged a broader return to work, even as he upped his estimate on how many Americans could die.
We're going to lose anywhere from 75, 80 to 100,000 people. That's a horrible thing. We shouldn't lose one person over this.
And the New York Times reported today that internal administration documents now project the toll could nearly double by June, with about 3,000 deaths a day. The White House downplayed the report, saying it had not gone through interagency vetting, but new modeling from the University of Washington showed similar results, a projected death toll of 135,000 due to relaxed social distancing. At the town hall, Mr. Trump also claimed early briefings from his own intelligence community failed to depict the severity of the virus.
On January 23rd, I was told that there could be a virus coming in, but it was of no real import.
Meanwhile, Europe's hardest hit countries are moving to loosen restrictions. Small businesses in Spain opened their doors to customers today, but owners like Susana Puebla at this nail salon in Madrid said it is far from business as usual.
It is not the same. It's not the way it was before. It's complicated now because we have to disinfect a lot more than before, but we are happy to be back.
And in Italy, nearly 4.5 million people returned to work in certain industries as the country logged its lowest new death count since the lockdown began in March. It's a different story in Russia, where infections spiked by more than 10,000 in the past 24 hours, bringing the total tally to double what it was last week. The world remains on guard. And amid a global hunt for a vaccine, leaders from Saudi Arabia to the European Union joined a virtual summit to pledge billions for research. The Trump administration decided not to take part. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Let's talk about some of these new reports about the projected death tolls and how it may be worse than what the president and some others had said recently, and what can be done to slow the spread of COVID. Lori Garrett is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and writer whose career has been devoted to tracking and reporting on infectious diseases. Lori Garrett, thank you so much for joining us. We do have these apparently two new grim forecast today. I want to ask you about the CDC report yet. We haven't seen all the numbers. The White House is saying it's not their numbers, but they are talking about by June 1st, 3,000 deaths a day. They're talking about up to 200,000 new cases a day. This is the wrong direction.
Absolutely, Judy, and it's a huge explosive growth they're predicting. And it's basically, if you look at the distribution that they're imagining, it's really the prairie states, the sort of Mississippi Valley, and the deep South states. And it seems, I think, though we don't have access to the raw data that they're working with, but it does seem to coincide with these outbreaks that have been occurring inside of meatpacking plants, nursing homes, Veterans Administration hospitals that have claimed large numbers of workers in those facilities, but haven't yet generalized into the larger community. And I think they're projecting that there will be generalization, that you know, an infected meat packer, for example, might then infect their family members. Some of those family members may infect local storekeepers and so on. So I think they're imagining a pretty explosive set of growths, all in fairly small, remote areas, and in many cases, rural counties.
And do you think it's the same explanation for this new model that we're told is coming today from the University of Washington, where they're projecting the total number of deaths in the U.S. at 135,000, way beyond what it was before? Is your reading of it same factors at work here?
Again, we haven't been given a lot of the details that are used for the analyses yet. But yes, I think they're also looking at higher than expected new infections and deaths in this swath of states that is the Mississippi Valley region all the way up to the Canadian border.
I want to ask you to listen to some things that we've heard from President Trump in recent weeks and ask you a question coming out of that. Let's listen.
The data suggests that nationwide we have passed the peak on new cases.
A minimum, if we did nothing, would have been 1.6. If you cut that in half, you're talking about 800,000, 900,000, a million people dying. But we did a lot of work, and I think right now we're heading at probably around 60, maybe 65,000.
I think we've done a great job. As you know, minimal numbers were going to be 100,000 people. Minimal numbers, we're going to be 100,000 people, and we're going to be hopefully far below that.
And Lori, I think a lot of people want to know, how is it that these projections could have been so off if it turns out to be these new numbers are right?
Well, first of all, this is not a stagnant situation. We have been trying to respond to the virus. So measures have been taken in various key states, New York, Washington State, California, Massachusetts, taking very strong steps to try and mitigate the spread by having people go into lockdown. Conversely, we have a number of states that have decided to actually back off. The state of Ohio today just said that the governor wants companies to be required to report the names of workers who don't go to the jobs as they open up. So that's, you know, the government demanding that you must risk your life. You must go into a meatpacking plant. You must go onto a job site. So we have a lot of actions being taken that make the situation quite fluid. And whatever the snapshot of a moment is that you make your projections off of is by definition going to be a different snapshot tomorrow and a different one the next day.
They're working, and yet the picture is more complicated than that. What is the message then, Lori Garrett, to the American people from all this, that clearly that they need to continue to practice the social distancing hand washing, just the basic elements that we have been practicing. But what more can Americans be doing?
Well, I think at this point, if I were the governor of any of these states that is projected to see significant increases, I would be ordering a lot of testing that is targeted to give me some policy guidance. I would test in meatpacking plants. I would test in school settings, if there are schools still open, every nursing home, every assisted living center, any place where I still have people co-housed, Veterans Administration centers. And I would want to know, do I have a trend day by day that shows increased transmission? And if I do, then that's a targeted community. That's where I direct my resources. I have to solve this problem immediately. If we don't take smart steps, guide our testing in wise ways, then we're just going to be flailing around, racing behind the virus, which will be consistently, Judy, way ahead of us.
And one other thing, Laura Garrett, you have said for a long time that Americans have never sufficiently invested in public health, and that's what's underlying so much of this.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at one of the key markers that indicates whether or not you as an individual are likely to have a severe outcome if infected and potentially succumb to COVID disease is hypertension. Well, hypertension is the cheapest, easiest intervention imaginable. You know, just slap the cuff on, check your blood pressure. And we have a raft of medications that will help you. We know how to bring down high blood pressure. That is a perfect marker for lack of access to consistent public health interventions and medical care. And when you look at the racial distribution and the class distribution on who is dying right now across America of COVID-19, you can see it is exactly the same as who's not getting treated for their hypertension, who's not getting appropriate basic health interventions on an ongoing basis. But a huge percentage of America has no consistent health care, doesn't have a doctor by name. A situation, a crisis of this scale hits, they have nowhere to turn. That we have a patchwork mosaic of public health systems, a patchwork mosaic of guidances and government responses. You cross a county line and it's a whole different ballgame. This is not the way to stop a national epidemic. This is chaos.
Well, no question, a lot of us are so much more fortunate than many, many other Americans. Laura Garrett, thank you so much for putting it in perspective. Science journalist and writer Laura Garrett, thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
In the day's other news, the U.S. Treasury said that it will borrow a record amount of money in this quarter to cover pandemic relief, nearly $3 trillion. That is well over twice the total for all of last year. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin warned that it's hard to tell if international travel can restart this year on anything more than a limited basis. He said Americans should focus on resuming domestic travel. For the first time ever, the U.S. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments by phone today from their homes or offices due to the pandemic. And in another first, the audio was heard live. The case involved whether the travel website Booking.com has the legal right to trademark its name. We'll take a closer look later in the program. The Supreme Court of Israel heard legal challenges today to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's governing coalition. He struck a deal last month with former rival Benny Gantz, among other things, it lets Netanyahu remain in office despite facing trial on corruption charges. His defense team argued today to a panel of 11 judges, all in face masks, that the governing bloc is legitimate.
We are in a situation where, in fact, inside this government are the two poles of the Israeli public. It's not that the government is not formed. The coalition and opposition were brought into the government and were given the possibility to serve together.
If the court rejects the coalition deal, it could trigger a fourth election in a little more than a year. Separately, the justices are considering whether Netanyahu can remain in office. Back in this country, the Secretary of the U.S. Senate declined Joe Biden's request to release any potential records on file involving a sexual assault allegation. The Secretary cited confidentiality rules. Former staffer Tara Reid says that then-Senator Biden assaulted her in 1993 and that she filed a report. The Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism are out. ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News were honored today for exposing a lack of policing in Alaskan villages. The New York Times won for international reporting on the Russian government, plus two other prizes. And the Washington Post won for its reporting on the environment. In the arts, the musical A Strange Loop by Michael R. Jackson took the drama prize. And Colson Whitehead received his second fiction prize, this one for the Nickel Boys, about a reform school in Florida. On Wall Street today, stocks managed modest gains. The Dow Jones Industrial averaged add 26 points to close at 23,749. The NASDAQ rose 105 points to close at 8711, and the S&P 500 was up 12. And the winningest coach in pro football history, Don Shula, has died at his home in South Florida. He had 347 victories with the Baltimore Colts and the Miami Dolphins. In 1972, he led Miami to the NFL's only undefeated season, winning the Super Bowl that year and the next. Don Shula was 90 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Trump administration continues to criticize China over the spread of the coronavirus and capturing images of the pandemic, perspective from a photojournalist.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
With, as we heard earlier, the number of cases expected to climb in coming weeks, many experts say the next phase in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic will require aggressive contact tracing. Amna Nawaz reports on how tracing works, why it could help, and the concerns over privacy.
Krista Cass's path to medicine was not the norm. A West Point grad, she served three tours of duty for the U.S. Army, then went on to become a physician's assistant in Boston. In March, like many places during the pandemic, all elective surgeries here were paused.
We can't operate and replace hips and knees right now. I just kept thinking, what can I do? How can I help? How can I be involved in this public health crisis?
Massachusetts has about 70,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. And last month, Governor Charlie Baker gave Krista her answer, announcing a new phase in the state's fight against the virus, aggressive contact tracing.
I was one of the first applicants. I could not wait to get my hands on this.
Krista was hired by Partners in Health, a Boston-based global health nonprofit working with the state to hire, train, and deploy 1,000 new contact tracers at a cost of $44 million. The process is straightforward but time-intensive. First, contact all new confirmed cases of COVID-19. Find out everyone they came into contact with while sick. Then reach out to those people to tell them that they may have been exposed and will need to quarantine.
What are the first lines you deliver to people?
I would say, hi, I'm Krista. I'm calling from the Community Tracing Collaborative at the Department of Health. I'm calling to let you know that you've been exposed in the past week to someone who was diagnosed recently with COVID-19. And then I take a break because that's a lot to handle and a lot to hear.
The work, she says, is about more than just informing people they might have been exposed. Contact tracers explain how to quarantine the right way, how people can protect their families, get groceries and medicine, pay their bills, even find help for domestic abuse.
We are not just collecting data. We're doing more than that. We are becoming extensions of our client, of our contact social support system, and we're connecting them with the resources they need.
Used around the globe in response to diseases like cholera, HIV, and Ebola, contact tracing has long been a critical public health tool to map and control outbreaks.
This is how you stop running away from the virus and start chasing it down.
Now with the Center for Global Development, Jeremy Kneindike helped manage the Obama administration's Ebola response in West Africa, relying heavily on contact tracing. Ramping up a national program here, he says, could not only help stop the spread, it could also help avoid large-scale shutdowns.
Because of inadequate testing and because we don't have a national contact tracing infrastructure in place in the United States, we in effect have to presumptively quarantine the whole population. But with contact tracing at scale and testing at scale, then you have the ability to quarantine only those people who have actually been exposed to the virus.
Digital tools to track people's movements, he says, like those used in Singapore, Israel, South Korea, and many other countries could also help. But tackling the scale of infection here in the U.S., on top of years of slashing state health budgets, means more federal leadership is needed.
The estimates now from Johns Hopkins are that we may need somewhere around 100,000 contact tracers across the United States. And I think that that's the sort of order of magnitude we need to be thinking on here. That's a lot of people, but also that's an achievable thing.
Some estimate the U.S. will need nearly double that number of contact tracers, but so far states are largely rolling out their own individual plans. North and South Dakota are two of a handful of states which have not issued stay-at-home orders during COVID-19. Together, they've so far seen around 3,500 confirmed cases with fewer than 50 deaths. Officials now hope a new location-based app can aid their efforts to keep the virus at bay.
It turns out that most people, including myself, can't remember on a good day where I was 5 days ago, let alone if you're sick.
Tim Brookins is an app developer in Fargo, North Dakota. In 2014, he developed Bison Tracker, an app that let North Dakota State football fans track each other as they travel together to away games. In April, he repurposed that app into this one, the Care 19 app, which tracks and compiles users' locations so if they do test positive, they can easily share that data with a contact tracer. Brookins says it will protect users' identities while making the process more efficient and accurate, but he acknowledges these efforts require buy-in.
It's hard. People need to really take time to digest, you know, what is the new normal after this and, you know, come to terms with the idea of location tracking.
Google and Apple recently announced they're working on contact tracing technology, too, to roll out in mid-May. But the rushed tech response has some privacy experts worried.
We're essentially building the airplane while it's flying.
John Callis is a former security expert at Apple, now with the American Civil Liberties Union. They recently published a report outlining principles to protect privacy and civil rights in contact tracing technologies.
Among those principles, that the technology used should be voluntary. Tracking information should be stored on a user's phone rather than a government or company server. The data should be routinely cleared out, and these programs should end when the pandemic does.
Callis says these are necessary steps not only to protect the public from increased surveillance, as seen in China, but for public health efforts to fight the pandemic to be effective.
We have to get the trust of the people who are using this. If people don't trust that this is a system that will benefit them and their community, they won't use it. They'll balk. They'll push back. I mean, we already see people in the United States who are pushing back on things.
Ultimately, though, experts agree that digital tools should complement human contact tracers, not replace them.
While the app may be efficient, it's not familiar, nor does it have a human voice on the other end of it saying, by the way, I know I'm telling you that you've been exposed, and the second thing I want you to know is I am here for you through this process.
A process to slow the spread, save lives, and maybe even prevent future waves of the virus. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz in Washington.
It was a Supreme Court argument unlike any other held before, not for the legal issues at stake, but for the logistics of holding proceedings during a pandemic, over the telephone and broadcasting live as it happened. Yamiche Alcindor begins there.
Today, the Supreme Court was in session, but you could hardly tell by the relative quiet outside the courthouse.
We'll hear argument this morning.
Instead, it was the voice of Chief Justice John Roberts that kicked off today's oral arguments over the phone.
Case 1946, the United States Patent and Trademark Office versus Booking.com. Ms. Ross?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
It's a first for the Supreme Court. Justices normally hear arguments together and in person. The socially distanced justices, four of them in their 70s and 80s, took turns questioning attorneys over the phone. The arguments they heard today had been rescheduled because of the pandemic. And there were the occasional glitches. For a few seconds, bad audio rendered Justice Stephen Breyer hard to hear.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Breyer?
Thank you.
But any issues were minor in an argument that also included questions from Justice Clarence Thomas.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Thomas?
Ms. Ross, a couple of questions.
It was just his third time posing questions at argument over at least a decade. Today's arguments were in a trademark case involving the travel website Booking.com. Also this month, cases about religious exemptions to the Affordable Care Act's birth control coverage mandate, disputes over subpoenas for President Trump's financial records, and the issue of faithless electors in presidential elections. Until now, for the public, following an argument live has meant having to get a seat inside the courtroom, where electronics are banned. For closely watched cases, long lines for seats are the norm. But in another first, the broader public could listen to today's arguments live. Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal.
The normal window into the operation of the court, especially during oral arguments, is really through the reporters who cover the court, the stories they write. There are several courtroom artists who draw pictures of the action. The audio of the argument is posted on the court's website, but not until the Friday of the week in which a particular case was argued.
In the few times the court has done same-day audio releases, they were for arguments in the most extraordinary of cases. Some lower federal courts allow news cameras in for some proceedings or provide audio or video streams themselves. But the Supreme Court's operations have a history of being slow to keep up with technology. For example, its opinions were printed using hot metal typesetting until the 1980s when it moved to electronic printing. Over the years, some justices have let it be known they have doubts about broader media access to arguments. Almost a quarter century ago, a House panel questioned now retired justices Anthony Kennedy and David Souter about letting news cameras in.
I can tell you that the day you see a camera coming into our courtroom, it's going to go rolled over my dead body.
As recently as last year, Justices Samuel Alito and Alega Kagan expressed their own concerns, also before a House panel.
Allowing the arguments to be televised would undermine their value to us as a step in the decision-making process. I think that lawyers would find it irresistible to try to put in a little soundbite in the hope of being that evening on CNN or Fox or MSNBC or one of the broadcast networks.
I think we would filter ourselves in ways that would be unfortunate. In other words, the first time you see something on the evening news which, taken out of context, suggests something that you never meant to suggest, suggests that you have an opinion on some issue that you, in fact, don't have.
But now that the court has adjusted to the times, at least for the first 2 weeks in May, will audio live streaming stick around, even after the pandemic has passed? For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
And you can listen to the Supreme Court oral argument yourself on our website at pbs.org/newshour. The war of words between Beijing and Washington is getting more aggressive by the day. Now, the Trump White House is boosting a theory that says the coronavirus was accidentally released from a research lab in Wuhan, where the outbreak began. Here's Nick Schifrin on the tense international politics of the pandemic.
Judy, that war of words accelerated yesterday with both President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo laying the blame on China and specifically on that lab in Wuhan. Let's take a listen to President Trump last night on a Fox News town hall suggesting that coronavirus was accidentally released from that lab.
And my opinion is they made a mistake. They tried to cover it. They tried to put it out. It's like a fire. You know, it's really like trying to put out a fire. They couldn't put out the fire. what they really treated the world badly on, they stopped people going into China, but they didn't stop people going into the USA and all over the world.
So is President Trump and the Trump administration right to point the finger at China for the coronavirus and the spread to the United States and the rest of the world? For that, we get two views. Tony Blinken is senior foreign policy advisor to presidential candidate Joe Biden. He served as deputy secretary of state in the Obama administration. And Rebecca Heinrichs is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. She's worked as a foreign policy advisor to Republicans on Capitol Hill. Thank you very much. Welcome both back to the NewsHour. Tony Blinken, let me start with you. So has President Trump been correct in pointing out that China, at least locally, covered up the virus in the early days, and that led to the spread of COVID-19?
So that's only half the story. Clearly, China, the government of China, has to be held accountable for failing to provide information in a timely fashion, failing to give access to international inspectors to get to the bottom of what happened. But the other half of the story is this. Unfortunately, tragically, the Trump administration took down or undermined a lot of the defenses that previous administrations had put in place to be able to warn of a pandemic, including a pandemic emerging from China. And then when the pandemic emerged in China and the system was flashing red, the president did virtually nothing about it and unfortunately misled the American people for the better part of 2 months about this danger that was heading our way.
Okay, Rebecca Heinrichs, you just heard a blaming of China, but do you believe there's a but there? Has President Trump failed in his response over the last few months?
No, I think it's much too early to give such a harsh grade to the Trump administration when we're just adapting to the data that comes in. The critical piece of why the Trump administration is so right to make sure that they counter the narrative that the Chinese government maybe made mistakes but isn't ultimately to blame. To counter that argument, you have to go out there and say what is true. And the truth of the matter is, it's not just that the Chinese government covered up, they obfuscated, they lied, they didn't give the information they needed, but they continue to this day to silence doctors, to censor academic research within China related to the origins of the virus. The onus is on the Chinese government, because it originated in their country, to show the world where this thing come from, provide all of the data that individuals need. And even to this day, they're still imprisoning people, disappearing people, and censoring them, which that's why there is such suspicion surrounding all of this. If China wants to be a world player, they're going to have to act like a responsible actor and demonstrate that they can be trusted on something so serious as this.
Tony Blinken, in late December, there were doctors in Wuhan who were trying to sound the alarm. Those people were silenced, and it took China weeks, at least publicly, to admit that there was human-to-human transmission. Is the Trump administration right to point all those things out?
Yeah, I agree with Rebecca that as a great nation, China has great responsibilities. And in this case, the responsibilities are even more acute because the virus originated in China. But we have great responsibilities, too, and our administration in particular does. And so, when you take down virtually all of the programs and personnel that were put in place by previous administrations to predict, prevent, and mitigate a pandemic, including one originating in China, that's a problem. And then when the pandemic starts to emerge in China and you ignore your own intelligence community, not once, not twice, but a dozen times. Remember before 9/11, there was a famous item in the president's daily brief saying bin Laden determined to attack the United States. That's based on Post reporting. The equivalent of what President Trump received not once, not twice, but a dozen times in January and February. And not only did he not insist that China live up to its responsibilities by giving access to our inspectors, by making sure that information was forthcoming, instead, at that very moment when China was not being forthcoming, what did he do? He praised the government in Beijing for being transparent. He praised it for its cooperation. And I might point out at that very moment, Joe Biden was calling on the president not to take the government's word for it in China, to hold them to account, to insist on the information, to get our inspectors into the labs in Wuhan.
Rebecca Heinrichs, I've talked to intelligence community officials who confirm that, yes, they were trying to sound the alarm in January. I've talked to National Security Council officials who also were trying to sound the alarm within the administration. They do fear that their response wasn't quick enough. What about that? Was the administration's response quick enough? Should the president have been more critical of China in January than he really was?
But I think if you look at there is a disconnect between the president's rhetoric through the early part of March and his policies that he implemented, including the travel restrictions from China into the United States. And I think part of that was because he was trying to calibrate a response to instill some trust in the market, not knowing exactly the effect that this virus is going to have inside the United States. I do think that was a mistake. That pales in comparison to, I think, a lot of the good that the administration is doing with the information they have. And again, it's not a side issue to keep going back to China. It is the central issue, because when President Trump sent out that tweet in mid-January, my understanding is the administration was desperately trying to get Americans in country to get a hold of the sequence for COVID-19 in order to get information. And so the president believed that he could flatter Xi Jinping at least enough to smooth out that relationship to get Americans in country, and that was his primary concern. We can argue over whether or not that was wise, but we can understand the motivation for him doing that. He's not confused about the nature of the CCP. To this day, there was a doctor in Shanghai that was trying to sound the alarm and give the genome sequence to other individuals outside the country, and then that lab was promptly shut down by the CCP. The wet market was sanitized. The animals were destroyed rather than having lab work from the animals when the WHO went in country. All of these things lead many people to be suspicious about why the Chinese government isn't being open and honest.
And I want to quickly turn to world leadership in the time that I have left. Tony Blinken, the World Health Organization repeated Chinese claims, which we now know to be incorrect, that the virus had no human-to-human transmission through January. And the Trump administration, of course, has been very critical of the WHO and has frozen funds to the WHO because of some of those mistakes early on. Do you believe that freezing could help create the reforms in the WHO that many believe are necessary?
As to the WHO, it clearly fell short of the mark. But it's ironic because the president says the WHO was not quick enough in pointing the finger at what was going on in China, and then wasn't critical enough of the Chinese government, which, of course, are accusations much more accurately directed at President Trump himself. Going forward, we need to make sure that the WHO can act effectively. My concern is this. As we pull out, who goes in? China. They will expand their influence in the WHO. They'll expand their influence in all the places that we're retreating from as a consistent matter in this administration. That's not a way to exhibit American strength, to show American influence. It is a way, actually, to help the government in Beijing expand its own influence.
Well, first of all, the United States government money combined with non-government money has given more than $6.5 billion to our allies and partners abroad to fight coronavirus. That's 12 times the amount that the Chinese government has provided. And then, of course, the United States continues to be, I think, give 40% to the World Food Organization, the World Food Bank, to make sure that these secondary effects that coronavirus is causing, the economic devastation to other vulnerable countries, to continue that there is still food there. So the United States is still the world leader in generosity and benevolence, and you can see that in the midst of this global pandemic. As for the WHO, the United States has still contributed far more to the WHO, even though the WHO was essentially acting like a mouthpiece propaganda outlet for the Chinese government. And so it's not all about money. Sometimes money isn't the thing that's going to influence organizations like the WHO. So I don't understand why people continue to say that we should be giving more money. And so I think that the Trump administration is absolutely right on to withhold funding until we see reforms in the WHO.
Rebecca Heinrichs, Tony Blinken, thank you very much to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks.
As the Senate returned to Washington and House members stayed home, last night on Fox News, President Trump declared the economy is on its way to a speedy recovery. Here to analyze the politics of his response and more, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and the host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Hello to both of you. And before I turn to you, I want to let you listen to some of what President Trump had to say at this Fox town hall last night, and also some of what Joe Biden had to say today at a different town hall that had to do with helping essential workers, particularly in the Latino community. Let's listen to both of those, and I'll come back.
You get a job where you make more money, frankly, and I think that's going to happen. I think we're going to have an incredible following year. We're going to go into a transition in the third quarter, and we're going to see things happening that look good. I really believe that. I have a good feel for this stuff. I've done it for a long time.
You know, I put out a detailed plan about what I think we should be doing right now to support our frontline workers and address the disparities we're seeing with COVID-19 impacts all across the country. And I truly think that if we do this right, we have an incredible opportunity to not just dig out of this crisis, but to fundamentally transform the country.
So, Amy, I'm going to come to you first. You have the president pivoting to talk about the economy at a time when, frankly, the numbers of cases and deaths on COVID are not looking very good. The president acknowledged that in part last night, but he's talking about the economy, saying it's going to get better. Joe Biden, on the other hand, talking about how we need to protect these frontline workers. What do you make of these two approaches? Here we are in May of this election year.
That's right. I mean, you could hear it with President Trump last night in that town hall. He was so nostalgic for that time before COVID when the economy was strong, his numbers on handling the economy so strong, and his focus was winning the election on the strength of a good economy. And now here we are with this pandemic that is not just devastating our health, but obviously devastating the economy. And he wants to, and he said over and over again, bring America back. We need to get Americans working. We need to get this economy back. With Joe Biden, what I find really interesting, Judy, especially that clip that you put in there, was, you know, Joe Biden was attacked by many in the progressive community for not wanting to be for not being progressive enough, for being really a status quo stand-in. And what he's doing is not just talking about bringing the economy back, but putting a focus on the people who are looking to make more structural. What he's looking to do is make more structural change by focusing on the people who right now are not just on the front lines. He talked a lot about meatpacking workers, but who also were doing poorly in the economy before the COVID-19 outbreak and continue to struggle even now.
And Tim, as you listen to this and you look at what these two candidates are saying, what does it tell you about where they see themselves in this contest?
Yeah, President Trump wanted his campaign slogan, had been sort of rolling it out to be Keep America Great. And now it's more like Make America Great Again. But, you know, you have a situation where you have the president of the United States with all the advantages of incumbency that a president of the United States has. And you have Joe Biden, you know, sort of stuck in his basement doing these webcasts, trying his best to campaign. But it's very different. And now, obviously, President Trump can't go do rallies. He's yearning for a day when he can get back out in an arena with 25,000 people. Unclear when or if that will happen. But certainly he still has the ability to, you know, get on Air Force One like he's going to do tomorrow, and sort of flaunt the power of the presidency.
That's right, Amy. The president tomorrow is going to fly from Washington to Arizona to visit a company where they manufacture protective gear, masks that people are wearing right now. How much of an advantage does the president have at a time like this? Joe Biden's at home.
Right. And you could hear in that audio, he wasn't just in the basement. He was sitting, I think, on some sort of porch or something. You could hear crickets or frogs or something in the background. Well, the president gets to not only fly in Air Force One, but sits at the Lincoln Memorial. The contrast couldn't be stronger. At the same time, even with those advantages, Judy, the president is still looking at approval ratings that are, in some cases, 20 to 30 points lower than governors in many of these states, red states, blue states. All these governors have used this opportunity in the spotlight under this crisis moment to meet that moment. This president has met it in the same way he meets every moment, which is in this very polarizing, sort of predictable way. And so what should be a big advantage of a bully pulpit has not worked out that way.
Well, and Arizona,
and Tam, go ahead, Tam.
This trip to Arizona is an official event. It's not a campaign event. But it's not a coincidence that the president is going to Arizona. It's a state that he won in 2016, but the reality is that it's fully in play in 2020. His campaign is, I talked to someone from his campaign today. They've had people on the ground there since 2015. But there's a real sense that this is a state that they're going to have to fight for, that, you know, Arizona used to be red Arizona, isn't a guarantee. And certainly it, under the current circumstances, it's not a guarantee.
So, Amy, you brought up the governors. We are seeing right now a number of states, I guess, what is it? They're saying 29, 30 states going ahead and planning to open up again, even with these forecasts of rising cases and deaths. And the states that seem to be moving ahead, more of them have Republican governors. The states that are saying, no, let's wait, more of them have Democratic governors. How partisan is this right now?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Judy. The Kaiser Foundation had an interesting poll out this morning that looked at, or some data out this morning, that looked at the rate of growth, especially over the last 2 weeks, in states that had Democratic governors and states that had Republican governors. Now, while it is true that states that have Democratic governors overall have more deaths, even per capita, than those who have red governors, when you look over the last 2 weeks at the rate of growth in both cases and deaths, it's the red states that are seeing an incredible uptick. So the question, and you're right to ask this, Judy, is what if this is true that we're not only going to see more cases, but more deaths in red states, is that going to change the perception by people who live in those states and governors on this issue? And what I found really interesting, I was digging through some polls taken in Michigan and in Florida. These are two battleground states. One has a Democratic governor, one has a Republican governor. When you ask voters in those states, how worried are you about actually contracting coronavirus? And then asked specifically, very worried or somewhat worried? The people who said they were very worried also happened to line up pretty closely with whether you were a Clinton voter or not. So in Michigan, it was something like 52% of Clinton voters said they were very worried about that, of getting coronavirus, 57% in Florida. But among voters who voted for Trump in 2016, a quarter or a third said they were very worried about this issue. So you can see at that moment, whether you have a red governor, you're in a red state, or a blue state, governor who's Democrat, governor who's Republican, the voter themselves and the ideological lens in, through which they're looking also is impacting how serious they believe the threat of COVID infection is.
Tam, you've got 30 seconds.
Sorry. Yeah, so I was talking to a researcher at Hamilton College about this, and he was pointing out that up until this point, there's been sort of a disproportionate weight of the coronavirus being borne by counties that were Clinton counties that went for Hillary Clinton. And there are also a lot of racial disparities that are underlying that and might explain why the politics are the way they are. But, you know, that could certainly change as the virus changes the way it affects the country.
So interesting, these numbers, state by state. We're seeing things we didn't see just a month or so ago. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, we thank you both.
You're welcome.
For weeks, photographer John Moore has been bringing his camera to the front lines of the pandemic to document the new realities of life in America. He has accompanied emergency medical workers, and he's gone inside intensive care units. Here's a look at some of what he has seen. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
I'm John Moore, and I'm a staff photographer and special correspondent for Getty Images. Getty Images sent me to Seattle. It was early March. A disease had already spread to a nursing home in Kirkland, Washington, which is just outside of Seattle. And so I was photographing the empty city of Seattle and what was happening outside of nursing homes. And I was in Seattle for about a week. And then I flew back once the crisis really began to be obvious here on the East Coast of the U.S. And my flight back from Seattle to New York City was virtually empty. And so I photographed really the emptiness, which would become our society in general in public places. And I began covering the epidemic really from the outskirts of the epicenter. But what affects New York City affects the areas all around it. So whether it's New Jersey, whether it's Long Island in New York, Westchester County, or southwestern Connecticut, everyone is affected in some way or another. I've photographed testing sites. I've photographed schools that are empty. I've photographed families at home to show what that looks like. Also for immigrant families, because I think the immigrant community, especially the undocumented community, is really highly affected. Many of them don't have health insurance, and very few of them have any protections when they're unemployed. Of course, when I'm photographing in intimate environments, it's important for me to maintain my own health so I can keep covering the story in a way that's meaningful to our viewers. On the other hand, it's so important for me to protect the people I'm photographing. For instance, I'll give you an example. There was one case where EMS workers in Yonkers went to a house and had to intubate a man who was barely breathing when they arrived. And that situation was just incredible to see. You hear about intubations, but you almost never see it. And so I tried to photograph it in a way that gave respect to the gentleman that they were trying to save, and they did, and still show the drama of the moment. And those are very, very delicate moments, very sensitive moments. When you talk to first responders, to paramedics, it's interesting, you know, yes, people are seeing them as heroes. They're doing heroic work, and it's amazing. But at the same time, it's incredible. People are just being heroes, doing the jobs they normally do. But that's what we have here, and I think we're all very thankful for them. For me, it's important that this story be told not only in terms of statistics. We hear about this all the time. Thousands of people infected, thousands of people died. But it's about human beings, and I want to show what that looks like, where people can really see what's happening to other human beings. It shows the heroism of the EMS workers who are doing this important work, and the hospital workers who are taking care of people on the other side. And if I can show that and bring it to a human level, then I've done my job.
And they truly are heroes, and we thank you, John Moore. And on the NewsHour online right now, libraries across the country have closed their doors during the pandemic, but it doesn't mean their work stops. As summer reading season approaches, librarians share their book recommendations for kids of all ages. You can find that list on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And before we go, May the 4th, did I say that right, has become an unofficial holiday for Star Wars fans. So we leave you tonight with an excerpt from composer and conductor John Williams and the Vienna Philharmonic playing the Imperial March as we all look forward to the day when we go to concerts and movies again. On this May the 4th, John Williams and the Vienna Philharmonic. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, stay safe. Thank you, and we'll see you soon.